Wouldn't you like to take a vacation from your bills? Well, you can. With credit card balances at an all-time high and Golden Oak's 5.25% rate, you could be saving thousands of dollars after a simple phone call. Call today and get your cash in as little as 14 days and make no payments for 2 months. Visit GoldenOakLending.com to speak to someone today.
Golden Oak Lending cured my blues.
6.19 APR, FHA, 15-year, 20% equity qualified credit. Additional terms apply. NMLS 114937.
Can't you see it? A sparkling roadside EV quick charge power facility. It's chargers, control panels, and switchgear powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean. We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We're now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Sports Radio 610 presents Area 45 with Bijani and Creighton.
8 o'clock hour. Appreciate you joining us. It's Area 45. He's Patrick Creighton, Sean Bijani, and Colin in for Chris Santiago, a.k.a. Will.
Did I say you mean Will?
Yeah, Colin, a.k.a. Will, vice versa. We don't really know his real name, but it's all
keep
good.
Guessing.
Keep guessing. Bob. I call everybody I don't know Bob.
Okay, hold Let's on. Let's do that. Quick concert check here for you, right?
Okay.
You get to go to, so huge concert fest,
mm-hmm.
bunch of bands.
Mm-hmm.
You could go to day one, or you go to day two.
Mm-hmm.
Day one, Kiss, Aerosmith, Pearl Jam, Nirvana.
Hold on, wait. Is this happening?
No, it's not happening. It's a theory.
Oh, okay.
So just like which bands you're like, The Doors, Leonard Skinner, Metallica,
ooh.
Van Halen, Talking Heads, Guns N' Roses.
Okay.
Day two, Rolling Stones, Queen, The Beatles, Black Sabbath, Pink Floyd, Led Zepp, Oasis, Radiohead, The Cure, and Iron Maiden.
And this is assuming they're all in their prime.
Yeah,
like,
yes, everybody's still alive.
Okay. Day two. And the reason is... I get to see, I've never seen Ozzy. Ozzy's on day two. I've already seen Metallica. They were on day one. That was like the big one for me. I've already seen them. And I'm going to go, I want to go see him again in June. You should come. It'll be fun. Who else? Give me the top four again on day two.
Stones, yeah. Queen, yep. Beatles, Sabbath.
Yeah. Stop right there.
Floyd.
Yeah, right there. And see, did you say Led Zeppelin too?
Yep.
Yeah. Day two.
Obviously,
easy.
I never saw Led Zepp because John Bonham died in 1980. But even though Iron Maiden is my favorite band,
yeah.
I've seen them 17 times.
Yeah,
I'm going to day one because I have no interest in seeing Oasis, Radiohead, or The Cure.
You know, it's a steep drop-off, but Oasis is good. Like, that takes me back to my high school
days. Like, the three songs?
Yeah, absolutely.
The only reason to see Oasis is to see if the Gallagher brothers will have a full-on brawl on stage.
Who are the Gallagher brothers?
They're the two guys who are Oasis.
Okay, I didn't know. Okay. Duly noted.
Are y'all like Rush?
I love Rush.
Yes, all love right, Rush.
Cool. I was just curious.
They're not on here because this is U.S. bands versus yeah. UK bands,
yeah.
And they're a Canadian band.
And they don't perform anymore since Neil Peart passed away.
Is that the lead singer?
No, he's a drummer.
Okay, because the lead singer for Rush is still kicking, I thought.
Yeah.
And he's a huge baseball collector. I saw he has like one of the most expensive baseballs ever. In his collection, which is ridiculous.
Would there be a 25% tariff on Rush coming to play in the States? That is a big question. Would there be a tariff on Rush coming to the States?
Do they not do this on the regular?
You know, I'm okay if they put the tariff on, you know,
Geddy
like
Lee,
Drake, because, you know, F him. But, yeah, no tariffs on Rush.
713-572-4610. Let's get out to the phones. Talk to Lamont. Before we get to some other baseball stuff here. Lamont, what's up, dude?
What's up, Lamont?
Hey, what's up, fellas? And by the way, I'm going on day two. I'm going on day two.
Yeah, that
on
boy.
Day two. You seeing the UK bands?
Yeah. I'm going on day two. But I had a question for you guys too. Before I get into my take, have any one of you guys ever been in the mosh pit or the wall of death?
Oh hell yeah!
The answer to that one from PC. I've never been. No.
Okay. When I was 18 years old, I had went. I'm just going to keep it real. Black people really didn't do the mosh pits or anything, but then it was this group, and I'm saying it facetiously, Wu-Tang Clan embraced all of that culture. And I went to a Wu-Tang Clan concert in Staten Island because Wu-Tang was in Staten Island. I drove up there to Staten Island from Virginia, and I was like, these dudes are like, it wasn't fighting, but it was very aggressive. It was very aggressive. It was different.
One of the most aggressive mosh pits I was ever in, Onyx. Onyx was a rough mosh pit. That was like worse than Exodus. I mean, Onyx was like those guys. That was a nasty pit, man. Those guys were beating the hell out of each other.
Yeah. But my question for you guys, I told the screener that I wanted to talk about the OC, and I'm actually talking about Bobby Slowick. This is just a little observation that I noticed that he was a young OC, and he was on the sideline. And it was just in my mind, would it have served him better to be inside of the booth to see the whole thing? And I know there's comms going on, communications going on back and forth with people like that, but I was just really wondering if it would have served him better to be in the sky, the eyeball in the sky, looking at things down from above to actually see how things go instead of being on that sideline. And I know that there's OCs like Kubiak can do it from the sideline, Andy Reid, a couple other players. But we're talking about a brand new OC to the game, and it just always puzzled me that he was not in the booth. I don't know if this is a big thing or if this is something that means anything, but to me it seems like it would have served him better if he would have been, up top. And going forward, if they hire another a young dude, I hope he's not on the sideline. I hope he's he or she, for that matter, is up in the top. And that's all I have to say, fellas. Pat, I want to hear some of your mosh pit stories, man. And I'm out.
All right, duly noted. Maybe save some of those for later. I would say I remember actually really well Bobby Slowick being asked about sideline or up in the booth, and he made no qualms about it. He was like adamant. He's a sideline guy. Like it was an easy decision for him. But what I was trying to look up right now is like how many coordinators are in, the booth versus on the sideline. Like I feel like far more is the case nowadays where they're down on the field. And I think probably the number one reason for that is one, you trust whoever is in the booth to see what you need to see from up there and relay that in a timely manner. But coaches want to be connected with their players. Like if they have something to say to a player or they need to get on the same page, like they're not waiting to put a headset on the player and all that stuff. Like, no, you get right to the player, you call them off the field or whatever. There's direct communication like immediately. And I think we saw that benefit Bobby Slowick. A number of times last year, one really sticks out in my mind, not this past season, but Stroud's rookie year. Remember the Dalton Schultz game where it was like during a timeout, whoever called the timeout bailed the Texans out in that instance. It was like a third or a fourth and goal type of situation or crucial yardage play in the opponent's territory. And that was the one where Dalton Schultz was like, hey, I've been doing this. And if I throw him a double move, I can do this. And that's going to get the safety to bite down. CJ ended up throwing Dalton Schultz a touchdown. Like, you don't get that direct communications and, effectively drawing stuff up in the sand when your coordinator's up in the booth. You know what I mean?
I totally understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. I almost feel like Bobby may as well have been in the booth because I don't think that those conversations took place this year the way they did the year before.
Yeah, I think you're right. We talked about that as well. Like, it never seemed like the like Stroud and those receivers had that synergy at any point in time this year that they did last year.
We've also heard a lot of rumblings about, you know, like free C.J. Stroud.
Yeah.
That he, you know, was kind of being restrained and restricted.
Yeah.
By what Slowick wanted to do, and that he didn't have the same, he didn't have the same freedoms he had as a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that makes no damn sense, to be honest with you. That's why I find it interesting that those rumblings have kind of been out there and persisted a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But look, like I said, the number one issue with Bobby Slowick to me this year was if there wasn't an injury, he wasn't adjusting.
If there wasn't
if
what?
If there was no injury,
oh yeah,
he wasn't adjusting. You just dilligaff. We'll keep throwing the same guy out there, and they'll tell us, well, we have to execute. Well, the guy you got out there can't execute.
Mm-hmm.
We'll throw him out there again.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's run this play. Couldn't execute it. All right, again, as I'm watching, you're watching the USA Olympic hockey movie with Kurt Russell,
mm-hmm.
where it's just like, again,
yeah.
make him do suicides up and down the rink. Again.
You know,
again.
To that point, do you think it's do you think guys are more like readily available and easier to find on the scrap heap defensively versus offensively? Like, is that an obvious question? Like,
no, I don't think that's an obvious question. And the reason I say that is it seemed like the Texans were able to find guys on the scrap heap more in 23 than they were in 24. Now, you could say that part of that is they were off to a faster start this year. You know, they started off last year 0-2. They won more games down the stretch. This year they lost more games down the stretch, so their waiver position was a little lower as opposed to the year before was a little higher. But we talked about how Nick Caserio kept finding guys on the scrap heap. And this year that didn't really happen. They couldn't get the guys. Like, they were just, their draft position was, their waiver position was too low. So mm-hmm. They didn't get those players.
But think about those guys.
And they did get a lot of those guys on defense. And the reason being was that's where they had their need. Early in the season, when offensive line was their need, they got guys on waivers and they got guys off the street. And they made, here, take our seventh round pick to, you know, give me this guy. They were trying to just bring in anybody early in the season when offensive line were just dropping like flies. But later in the year, as the season went on, they didn't really have the opportunity to go grab a wide receiver or another tight end, right? And I do think that Caserio is somebody who believes that it's harder to bring in an offensive player than a defensive player. Like, look what they did with Deontay Johnson. Like, they really didn't give him an opportunity, and then he was out the door. You're telling me Deontay Johnson wasn't at least the second best receiver on the team in terms of talent?
Yeah, hell yeah, he was.
And they weren't. He didn't really get an opportunity. Why didn't he get an opportunity? Well, you weren't here all year. You don't know all our stuff. You only know some of the plays. Like, so what? He knows some of the plays. He's a better option on those plays than anybody else on your roster, not named Nico Collins.
Yeah, you would
think.
But
that's how they operate. Look, that's how the Ravens operate. They did the same exact thing. So, kind of why I didn't understand, if you just saw him lose his mind with the Ravens because they didn't play him, and then you bring him to your team, what made you think it was going to be any different? Why did a guy who just lost his mind over getting 39 snaps in 6 weeks?
I mean,
and then you bring him in here and you're like, hey, listen, you know what? We're going to sit you on the bench too.
Yeah.
Who thought that was a good idea?
I mean,
no, but you weren't looking at it as we're going to bring you in and sit your ass on the bench. You're like, we're going to bring you in and we're going to get you on the field. And if you know 30% of the plays, we're going to use you on those plays because we think you can make an impact and be a little bit of a difference maker on those plays that you know. Not, yo, pop a squat.
Yeah. Well, here's, I think, the only thing I can think of is maybe, one, the guy's just a little slow. And didn't catch on, you know, with the playbook. But we're talking about also, too, a guy that is an all-pro as a punt returner. We're talking about a guy that has caught passes for a really good team, the Pittsburgh Steelers, more than 1,000 yards before in a season and flirted with it back-to-back years. But we're also talking about a guy who was the best on a really crappy Panthers team. And at the time, like the number four guy, and then he turned in to be the number three guy and refused to go in with Baltimore. And he's either like really a slow mover when it comes to picking stuff up, or he's just what we think he is, a freaking ass. And he didn't learn his lesson the first time or the second time or the third time. And then when he's blessed to have the opportunity to be given a shot at playing for a playoff team like the Texans.
Well, he was just he on screwed a playoff that one team up in the too. Ravens.
I know, and he screwed the pooch.
But he wanted to play because he's in a walk year.
I know, but when he got the opportunity to play, he said no. No, thank you.
He had 39 snaps in 6 weeks.
Sure, but they called his number and he said no. Because so he's a quitter.
Probably thought he was going to be a... Like, I'm not saying he handled it right. I've never said he handled it right. What I'm saying is I understand the massive frustration of... You're a guy, you were a legit receiver in Pittsburgh, you were the leading guy in Carolina, you get to Baltimore, you are better than any receiver on that team, not named Zay Flowers, and they're like, yeah, you're wide receiver five. Why the hell did you claim me to be wide receiver five?
Yeah, well, look, it was just so funny, because whenever the Texans did claim him, we'd found out like the day before a game, and then after the game, was the first time that we had an opportunity to ask players about the Texans claiming him. And we asked John Mechie. In fact, Adam Spillane specifically asked John Mechie about Deontay Johnson being claimed by the Texans and what that means. And he said, depth. Right? As in taking it two ways, like, one, yes, you're correct. That is the correct answer, sir. But also, you're choosing not to elaborate leads me to believe that you're probably not thrilled with them claiming somebody off of the scrap heap, and it's a direct line to what they think of you. Or
no, it's
how
a direct
little they think
referral of what they think of them. But if then, they thought Mechie could be the guy, they wouldn't have picked up Deontay Johnson.
But then, you know, actions speak far louder than words at times. Their actions did not say that we value Deontay Johnson far more than John Mechie or Xavier Hutchinson or Robert Woods or Jared frickin' Wayne.
Not even as Mechie sat there and dropped three passes.
Who got more reps offensively in the final three games of the season at receiver? Is it Deontay Johnson or Jared Wayne?
It wasn't Deontay Johnson.
I think it was Jared Wayne. I swear.
It was crazy. It was the tank killer.
Yeah, jeez. Oh, man. You know, it's funny. This is like this guy, Deontay Johnson, is like somebody that you and I, like, we've had like our most passionate conversations about.
And the thing is, like,
and he means ass, like, you to anybody here.
Literally could have just worked with him a little better. And then you could have like brought him in next year, probably for cheap. But you don't have Tank next year. You're telling me that. We'll let Deontay Johnson, who's a lot younger than Stephon Diggs. We can work with him. You can be our number two receiver next year.
We were already
talking about that. And then let's go draft another guy. Nope, not going to do that. Now, okay, but your options for where you're going to go are getting to be more and more expensive, and the amount of money that you have is not very much, so you're going to have to do some cat magic.
Dude.
Now, I trust Nick Cassero to do cat magic, but he's got to do cat magic.
Yeah, I was so... all in on this asshat, Deontay Johnson, and I screwed the pooch on that
but,
one.
But here's the thing. You don't know what the conversations were that they had when he first got claimed. Because you know there was a conversation.
Sure.
You know, hey, this is what we envision for you. You know, are you on or off the bandwagon? Mm-hmm. Is this because, you know what? I'd want to know that this guy is on board with what I want to do before I claim him.
Mm-hmm.
There were conversations probably before they claimed him, after they claimed him. And, you know, in the game against the Titans at the end of the year, they got him some run. They just, hey, just go run these routes. We'll try to involve you. And then you get to the game against the Chargers. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
You know, he gets one target, which he catches for 12 yards. And that's it. You only look, he got the whole game. He only played like 14 snaps. What are you doing?
What if Bobby Slowick got all up in his feelings, you know? And Bobby was like, hey, we're going to run this. And maybe Deontay was like, oh, yeah, well, we call that this in Pittsburgh. We called it that in Baltimore.
You're in the effing NFL now.
It's the Houston Texans. We call it this here. And maybe that's why he was all up in his feelings and got cut. You know, D'Amico's like, well, can't fire Bobby right now.
They should have fired him week 10.
We had agree to disagree on that one. All right, coming up next, Astro Legends weighing in on fractured relationships and ideas about Jose Altuve playing the outfield. We'll get to all of that next.
Looking for a new home should be exciting, not frustrating. That's why Homes.com might just be the best home shopping site out there. Imagine searching for your dream home without ads cluttering your view. Homes.com's sleek, beautifully designed, ad-free interface makes your search simple and distraction-free. And if you're a parent, you know how important school information is. Homes.com gets it. They're the only site with detailed school and district info from multiple sources, including reviews from Niche. Plus, they've got a super comprehensive and transparent agent directory, making it easy to find the right expert to guide your journey. Oh, and here's a game changer. Homes.com always connects you directly with a listing agent who knows the home best. They even go beyond the basics, offering the most in-depth neighborhood content of any home shopping site, packed with details to help you find a community that feels like home. And the search tools? Unmatched. With 22 data visualization layers, 7 environmental layers, and filters for commute times and architectural styles, Homes.com truly is the home search you've been searching for. Go to Homes.com. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 45% off select styles and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Save up to 45% at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Radio 610 presents Area 45 with Bijani and Creighton.
All right, welcome back to the show. It's Area 45. I'm Sean Bijani, Patrick Creighton here as well. Colin, a.k.a. Will, producing in for Chris Santiago. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610. 572-4610, call or text Twitch, YouTube. You can join the chats there as well. Made early official official earlier this week, let me say that. Ryan Pressly was officially traded after waiving his no trade clause, accepted a deal with the Chicago Cubs, joins his buddy Kyle Tucker up there. In exchange, Astros got a minor league pitcher, nothing to write home about at all right now, by the name of Juan Bello. And that move was thought to be the impetus of another move to facilitate a re-up with Alex Bregman. That obviously hasn't happened yet. We're still waiting. But what we learned in the course of that deal, or rather after the fact, from Dana Brown, Astros general manager, speaking to the media after the deal and described his relationship along with Ryan Pressly's relationship and why it began fractured this past season?
I think the relationship took a slightly different turn. Anytime you take a major league player out of a role where they feel comfortable, I think it's going to fracture your relationship some. I think we continue to communicate. He was a true professional, and I kept it real as a true professional myself. And so ultimately, I wouldn't say it was the same as when we first met. There was some frustration, which I would totally understand from a competitor. You're moving a guy at a position who felt like he didn't deserve to lose his job. And, because you acquired, another elite closer like a Hader. And so, the whole purpose in doing all that was to really lock down the back end. And so I know in his heart of hearts, he wanted to close.
So there's a lot there. And to kind of just rewind a little bit, that came out, if you think that came out of nowhere for Ryan Pressly, I mean, it obviously came out of nowhere for, I think, the rest of us, too. The Astros giving Josh Hader $95 million over the next 5 years to be their closer when they already had one, and Ryan Pressly and his resume. You know what it is. You know what it has been with the Astros. But we were talking at the time that offseason about, like, hey, Blake Snell, Jordan Montgomery, Astros going to get themselves another pitcher, knew you needed some arms.
Yeah, the Astros, remember the Astros were getting in on Blake Snell at the very end, but then they mega lowballed the snot out of him, so of course they didn't get him.
Yeah, I remember that was a Friday show where that news broke, and we were so excited. We were like, boy, we're going to come in on Monday, and we're going to have some Blake Snell to talk about.
Yeah, Friday, oh, the Astros are getting in on them, and then it was, yeah, they offered a joke of an offer.
Yeah,
it was, and please. They were like, you can get to stepping with
that. Yeah, kick rocks, man. So all that happened, and I thought this was pretty funny, though. I have not heard a player or a former player's reaction to this fractured relationship that we've learned about and could have guessed, honestly. I mean, when you're the general manager, you basically demote a guy who has been every much as part of your success and winning a World Series as Ryan Pressly had and the postseason success, like, as anybody. You demote him for a $100 million closer? Like, did you need one of those, Dana? Well, Chandler Rome has a podcast, and apparently gracious enough to take some time out of his ski trip was Josh Reddick, a former Astro, on the ski slopes, like in full gear. Like, I guess just got done sliding down the side of a mountain and decided to hop on with Chandler Rome and his podcast for a few minutes. Was asked about the recent breakup between Pressly and the Astros, and here's what it sounded like.
Josh, you've been around a lot of executives. You've been around a lot of, clubhouses, things like that. How surprised were you to hear Dana Brown be that candid about his fractured relationship with Ryan Pressly?
Very. I mean, this is a business and a sport on professionalism and a bunch of grown men just, talking out face to face. If you can't talk face to face with anybody in this business, you're going to lose a lot of respect for that person individually. So I'm sure that Ryan lost a lot of respect for somebody like that just to come out and say, our relationship was fractured and probably would have been no matter what. But, I think that something should have been done about, talking to Ryan a little bit better about it and just, being a little bit of a man about it, because, these things, you see these guys all the time. You don't want to have sour relationships because you never know how that's going to affect the player. And he may not want to go out there and, perform his best for you. And he's still going to be a great teammate because Pressly is a great guy and a great teammate. So he's not going to hold that grudge. But to have that come from somebody in that position, it's pretty hard. It's a pretty tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was so.
You can go ahead and cut it there. So here's the thing. Is this being blown out of proportion a little bit, like this fractured relationship between Dana Brown and Ryan Pressly? Like, if you listened to that from what Josh Reddick just had to say, he either knows something that we don't, which is wouldn't be a surprise, probably the case, or he's like going a little too far in hinting or alluding to like the lack of communication between Dana Brown and Ryan Pressly, which I thought had been well documented to this point, that there were conversations had, both acknowledged as such, in spring training this past year about how this all went down, why it went down. And I get like a fractured relationship because you make the move, but I don't understand why it's something that really had to continue between the two sides.
Well, I know in you know, during the training camp, they tried to poo-poo that and blow it over. But I think the real part of the story is Ryan Pressly found out Josh Hader was acquired by the Astros and was going to be the closer after they traded for Josh Hader and made him the closer.
Mm.
And Presley's always been a team guy. He's not a me first guy. And he towed the party line and he did his best to keep his mouth shut and keep his head high and be a good teammate and do his job. And I think it ate at him all year. And when you're a guy who's had the career with the Astros that Ryan Pressly had with the Astros to get blindsided the way he did, but Ryan Pressly didn't do something to cause him to lose his job.
Mm-hmm.
It just got taken from him.
They yeah.
said, hey, we're gonna bring this to that and we're going to give him the closer role. You're not going to share it. It's not going to be like co-closer thing. Just we're giving it to him.
Wouldn't have been the worst idea.
And I do not doubt that that seriously impacted how he felt about his value to the team, the way he was appreciated. No doubt about that, because I think that would happen to anybody. I think if, for example, if you and I were doing an afternoon drive and then all of a sudden our boss came in and said, hey, look, we hired this new guy. We're kicking you guys to midnight. I'd be pissed.
Or, you know, hey, we're kicking one of you to midnight and one of you gets to stay. You know what I mean?
That, oh, one who got kicked is really pissed.
Yeah, the you one know? That got kicked. 100%. 100%. I always think like this type of relationship between like general manager to player is it's commonplace, but apparently it's still kind of not, or at least in the way that Josh Reddick described it, not commonplace. I think of the movie Moneyball in this instance.
I can't develop personal relationships with these guys. I got to be able to trade them, send them down, sometimes cut them. Which is something you should learn to do, by the way.
I would never have to cut a player unless you... Oh, come on.
Come on what?
You can stop it right there.
Let's practice.
You remember that scene? Like, I go back to that all the time because... You know, that was Brad Pitt's character playing Billy Bean. And, you know, he's telling his assistant GM, like, hey, man, you know, I can't have a relationship with these guys. Like, I need somebody else to take care of this stuff. And it's going to have to be you. And you remember the scene, like, you know, a few minutes later in the movie, like, he's sitting down with a guy and it's like, hey, you know, we traded you to so-and-so or whatever. And
oh, like, that was the first baseman, right?
Yeah, he's like, okay, whatever. And it works out for him, but. Does Dana Brown, like, is that not really the way that it is? I know there's a whole bunch of inaccuracies in the movie and stuff like that. And, of course, there's going to be. But, I mean, how important is that or is that not, like, for a general manager to not have a relationship with a player? Because this is the case all the time, a lot in Major League Baseball. Some days you're here and then the next day you're not.
You know, I don't know if the GM has to have great relationships. I mean, that's kind of a... That's the manager needs to
yeah, have those. That's what I thought.
You know, from that point of view. So I don't know if that's necessarily 100% how that needs to go.
But like because
but you need to have trust.
Sure.
You can't have like if your player doesn't trust you, that's a totally different issue with how you deal with your players in that regard. That is a totally different thing there. Carlos Pena, that's the guy who...
Was it Pena that got
who got told, hey, listen, we're trading you.
Yeah.
And he was probably very happy to be traded.
Carlos Pena, who is now an analyst on MLB Network.
The
Carlos Pena.
Remember they started putting Scott Hatterberg at first base?
Yeah.
Hatterberg was a catcher and he had hurt his arm and he couldn't make the throw anymore.
Yeah.
So they put him at first base.
The interaction between David Justice and Hatterberg in the break room in the clubhouse. You know, when Justice is like, after he has that conversation with Billy Bean, and Billy Bean's like, you do your job, you know, you be the leader and da-da-da, you know, help the guys out, you know, make them feel good. And Justice finally comes around to that, and he asks Hatterberg, like, so, what's your biggest fear at first base? It's like, anytime the ball's hit my way.
Yeah.
And then Justice is like, no, really. And Attenberg's like, no, really. That's one of our
favorite. And it's funny. Like, how many times you hear, and you hear it like from when you're a little kid on, right? Whoever's afraid of the baseball will find
you. Oh, guaranteed. Guaranteed, 100%. 713-572-4610. You want to be a part of the conversation. Coming up next, we will get to Craig Biggio. What he thinks about the idea of Jose Altuve moving to the outfield. That's next. Stay there.
Live from the Mokarem Injury Lawyers Studios, Sports Radio 610 presents Area 45 with Bajani and Creighton.
Sean Bajani, Patrick Creighton back with you. Area 45. Make sure you're listening to Sports Radio 610 on the Odyssey app for an hour each day. You can enter by just downloading the Odyssey app and creating a login. That gives you an entry into the Slam Dunk in Vegas National Contest. You do it every day for an entry every day. And the winner is going to be headed to Vegas with a flight, hotel accommodations, three friends also get to go, plus $20,000. And it gets you the ultimate viewing experience for the first couple of rounds of the college basketball tournament. So just make sure you're downloading the Odyssey app and then creating that login and listen for at least an hour every single day. We prefer you do it to this show. That would be awesome. Craig Biggio spoke with MLB.com's Brian McTaggart, covers the Astros for them, does a fantastic job. Biggio was asked by Brian McTaggart here this week about his thoughts on what Jose Altuve, as we have come to find out, proposed to the Houston Astros, moving to the outfield, specifically left field, in effort to bring Alex Bregman back so he could play third base and Isak Paredes could move over to second base. Biggio had this experience a couple of times over in his baseball career. Started off as a catcher in the late 80s and moved to second base about 4 or 5 years after the fact, and ended up in center field patrolling Towels Hill for a year or so, and then moved to left field a little bit, back to second base before he called it quits. So he knows a thing or two about having to adjust the body, PC. Does Biggio think Altuve could pull it off at this stage of his career? Biggio said, quote, he'll be fine. He's a tremendous athlete, and he'll have enough time in spring training to figure it out and get through it. He weighed in on some more of the intricacies of the outfield position that Altuve is going to be in for. He said, quote, it's totally different training as far as on your body. When you're playing the infield, it's short spurts. When you're playing the outfield, it's a lot of long distance running. In the infield, you might have 5, 6, 7 steps of short spurts. In the outfield, you might have 30, 40 steps. It's totally different running program, at least it was for me. The throwing program, he says, was totally different because it was a different arm motion than it was playing the infield or catcher. Playing catcher or second base, it was short arm throws. And then when you went to the outfield, it was long arm throws. And that was weird. Just a little bit from Craig Biggio on kind of the breakdown and the intricacies. But ultimately, he says he's going to be fine.
I say, usually catcher is not a short arm throw.
Well, what he means,
you're trying to gun it down there as hard as you can.
You are, but there's not a big, you know, whipping motion. You know, catcher, you're popping that ball out of the glove, and it's right back here by your ear, and it's boom.
That motion is all about how fast you pop.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know,
whereas at second base, I had to learn this, right? Because I went from third base to second base one particular year. And my first baseman thought I was going to kill him for the first, like, 2 weeks that I was learning to play the position, as I'm fielding balls and then slinging them over as hard as I can at his face. And it's like, you know, when you go into the hole at second base, pop up and gun one, it's like, dude, you're 10 feet. You don't need to gun it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, just don't short hop it. And you know, I had to actually change my entire throwing motion.
Mm-hmm.
Because at third base, you come over the top. That's a long throw across the diamond. You're shooting it. When you're at second base, now all of a sudden I'm throwing sidearm.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying not to sling it over his head.
Yeah, he had the Chuck Knoblauch complex.
Yeah, I didn't hit any moms in the face or anything in the first throw. But yeah, I had to totally change my throwing motion because, you know, throwing over the top, I had a high release point, and I would zoom it over his head or at his face every time.
Mm.
And I had to learn how to, you know, more center mass it from second base, and
yeah,
that became a sidearm type of thing.
Yeah, it is definitely different. I mean, you know, when you're kids, you play all over the place, especially now. But it is different. Here's one final quote.
By the way, I hated playing second base.
Why?
Because I did not like guys coming down on me from the blind side where I couldn't see them. You know,
former hockey player, you're worried about this?
Well, yeah, because I didn't like getting spiked in the back of the leg. You know, when you play short, you see them coming. You're already in your throwing motion as you're hitting the bag.
Yeah, yeah.
From second base, you're getting to the bag, then getting the throw,
yeah.
Then you pivot. If I could get the throw, and one of the guys I used to, who played short when I was playing second, I was like, don't throw the ball to the bag. Throw the ball to me. I will catch it, hit the bag, and throw it all in one motion. Just get me the ball, screw the bag.
Yeah.
That made my life a lot easier.
Yeah, yeah. If you can do it.
You know, he would throw the ball to me, and I might still be a step or two from the bag, but I was just like, just hit me with the ball. I'll kick the bag and throw at the same time. Whereas standing there with your foot on the freaking bag waiting for the throw is how you get murdered.
Here's the self-deprecating Craig Biggio about his outfield experience. Quote, it was a totally different animal. I made some really nice plays in left field, and I made some plays you would scratch your head at. It's definitely different. The ball in center field comes at you true. And the ball in left field doesn't come at you true. Even though the positions are right next to each other, the way the ball comes at you is a lot different than it does in center field. I learned a lot when I went to left, that's for sure. I thought about this. I'd forgotten that Biggio went to left field. I don't know how much left field he played actually at Minute Maid. Maybe that was more something that he did on the road. I don't know. I always remember him in center field. But I don't know what little he could possibly help, like a guy like Jose Altuve, in making that move. If in fact that was something that ends up happening, probably can a little bit. You know, he's a guy that generally works out with this team, you know, for spurts and spring training every year, and is around the ballpark and probably helps these guys with various things mentally. I would say the game and maybe at the batter's box, but. I think it's something to kind of entertain. I know it doesn't sound good. I know it doesn't picture well in your mind, but it didn't either when Biggio did it. It didn't either when Lance Berkman did it. And both of those guys to, you know, keep their bats in the lineup and stay on the field, they had to do it. Biggio did it when Jeff Kent came on. I don't remember exactly why Lance Berkman had to do that. Play center field, Minute Maid for crying out loud, but.
So Craig Biggio played 109 games and left. 83 of those.
Nine more than I remember.
83 of those came in 2004 at age 38.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In 04, he split time between center and left.
Meanwhile,
the next year, he was back at second base.
Somebody put a Twitter video. Well, that was the year he retired, right?
He retired 3 years later.
Okay, 3 years later. Damn, okay, so I guess he did finish out at second base, yeah.
He had one game, he caught one game in two innings of catcher in 2007.
I remember that, was at that game, that was his final game. He played all positions, catcher, second base, and outfield. That was pretty cool. Somebody put a Twitter video up the other day. I was looking, well, first the video said, like, Altuve to the outfield, you know, remember this from Biggio, and it was the one game, one video that somebody had found of him in left field and a ball just kind of glancing off the top of his glove and off the scoreboard at home and left. And I was like, okay, but what about this? And I was ready to find the video of a catch that I remember Craig Biggio making. Not the Lance Berkman one where he falls down and, you know, kind of basket catches it and falls on his butt. Biggio made an awesome catch on Taos Hill. And there's no video of it. I can't find it anywhere.
The one where he's like dives headlong back towards the wall.
It was Willie Mays. Yes, it was the Willie Mays catch. He made that catch on Taos Hill. There's no video of it anywhere. Top catches on Taos Hill. Nowhere to be seen. Like they have like four or five catches from some slaps, you know, in like modern era, like Astros, like before they killed the Hill a few years ago, like in the new unis. And all that stuff. And then they have the Berkman. They got, I can't remember. some just nondescript. Like the Biggio catch was probably the best. It was better than Berkman's catch. Way better than Berkman's catch. It was Willie Mays-esque on Towels Hill. He should be remembered for that in the outfield as much as anything else. I know he wasn't great out there, but he made a great catch. Are you looking up the videos? You're not going
to
find it.
I'm trying to find some video here that might be of Biggio. I'm working on
it. No, there's nothing. I've scoured the internet for the last 2 days just to make this point, and I have nothing to support my memory of it.
Did you lose sleep over that?
I might tonight. Biggio's my guy. You don't know this, but Biggio's my guy. That was my childhood hero. There was my grandfather, and then there was Craig Biggio. Like, high regard, man. That was my dude. But hey, by the way, PC, you know our producer, Colin, tonight.
Will.
Will is, do you see what he's wearing?
No.
Show Patrick what you're wearing. He's wearing
an old school Rockets jersey.
Tell me you have the camera on YouTube. You don't. Come on, man. Stop being so humble. Put the damn camera on your ass so let the people see what you're wearing. He's wearing an old school Hakeem Olajuwon pajama jersey, minus the pinstripes. And he's proud of this earlier. He shows me, right? Just look at this. I'm like, oh, that's badass. You know, it's a good jersey, you know, because it doesn't have the it's the Rocket teeth jersey without the pinstripes, which is horrible. But I said, you know, we're in conversation about, you know, players leaving, Bregman, the whole thing. And I'm like, you know, that guy you're wearing, he played in Toronto to finish his career. And he's like, what? I said, yes.
He's wearing an Olajuwon jersey?
Yeah, he's wearing an Olajuwon jersey. I said, he finished the last 2 years of his NBA career, his Hall of Fame career in Toronto, in freaking Canada. Like, if there was ever a guy that you didn't think needed to or would ever think about playing in a different city or for a different organization, be Hakeem Olajuwon. And that happened. That happened. And he's just like, you know, blown away, mind blown.
You learn something new every day. I feel bad, though, because I feel like I should know that already.
You should know this. Now, how old are you?
I turned 24 in November.
God bless. And we think Byron's young and Chris is young. This cat's young. So, yeah. Go do some homework on that. Like, players that had no business playing for other organizations in their respective sports. I think of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays every single time. Don Mattingly, Wade Boggs, Jose Canseco, Sammy Sosa, Tampa Bay Devil Ray at one point in time.
I don't recall that, but that doesn't mean he wasn't. But I don't recall that.
He probably wasn't. He probably wasn't. I probably made that up in my mind.
I think you might have made that one up.
All right. Coming up next, 9 o'clock
Sammy
hour.
Sammy was an Arlington junk grabber.
Oh, I knew that. That's how he started before he went to Chicago.
That's where he ended his career.
Okay, so he ended
and
there.
And he also was a... he also played in Baltimore. He was a hoe.
Baltimore, that's the one I remember,
He was a Baltimore hoe.
That was late in his career.
And then he played a long time with the Cubs. Before that, it was the White Sox.
White Sox, yep.
And, yeah, started with the...
Rangers,
the
White Sox, Rangers. Cubs. It's the Orioles that I remember him being on. Yep. All right, coming up next, you're going to be on or off. It's the bandwagon. Stay put.